So we're on the blue rite, or the black rite of destruction today. And of course we know a bit about the black rite of destruction because you may remember it's what Milarepa practiced. His family were cheated out of property and land by his uncle. And on the urgency of his mother, he went to train with a black magician, and trained in magical spells, and produced a hailstorm that destroyed all the village's crops, and then later killed his uncle's family and some of the village who had gathered for a wedding. And it's very interesting, if you read that story of Milarepa, when he undertakes the black rite and he's sort of in debt to this black magic guru, there's a certain point where he goes back to his teacher. He's produced another hailstorm to destroy some crops actually of a different village. And he goes back to the land that he's just destroyed, and he finds one tiny bird that he's killed in the hailstorm, and he picks up the bird and he takes it to his guru's feet, and he places the bird at his feet and says, "I can't do it anymore." And it touches me a lot that you know, he'd killed human beings, he'd destroyed livelihoods, he'd got himself into a state of real intense hatred, and it was that tiny bird that became to him a symbol of what he'd done, and he laid it at his teacher's feet. And sometimes, you know, we can feel like that ourselves if we've been overcome by hatred. There's something small, or any kind of negative mental state, there's something small that might just remind us of the fragility and the beauty of life that we've destroyed in some way. So the Buddhist tradition took this rite and turned it to the blue rite, evoking the cloudless blue sky. So the cloudless blue sky is a very rich symbolism in the Buddhist tradition. Akasa in Pali, Akasha in Sanskrit. Yes, this beautiful blue sky, free from any obstacles, any kind of veil from the sun, an intense blue, a really vivid blue that we don't get that often in this country, but we've been very blessed in the last few days to have. And if you lie on your back and you really look at a blue sky, your mind travels outwards, beyond obstacle, into a sense of vastness and space. And that became a symbol from the enlightened mind itself. It becomes the colour of reality, open, vast, truth unobscured. But I think this rite, when I bring to mind this particular, the colour of this particular rite, I think of it as something a bit darker, actually. It's the deep, deep blue. Blue as the deep sea, blue as... they say midnight in the tropics. So I don't know if anyone's been snorkeling or diving, particularly on a coral reef. And it's really beautiful, and there's all these kind of beautiful fishes and coral, and you're going along, do-do-do-do-do. And I'm a bit frightened of the sea. And then you get to this cliff, and then in that is the great unknown. And if you've got a highly imaginative, highly active imagination, You know that Jaws is coming. It's really quite frightening. So, yeah, that's the feeling of the blue rite, the deep blue rite. You've gone off the edge of the cliff. You've gone off the edge of the coral. And what comes from the depths? It's the blue inside of Padmasambhava's cave. So some of you remember that Padmasambhava's cave, it said, has a set of footprints coming in, but none coming out. So it's that. It's the mystery. Deep, deep, deep blue. Humming with energy and vibrancy. Boom, boom, boom. And I talked before about the creation myth, about the gods stirring the milk of the universe. And something happens with that. So if you remember, the gods stir the milk of the universe in order to create the world. And all these wonderful things come out, things that they really want, jewels and perfumes and flowers and trees, all these beautiful things. And at the end comes the poison, the kind of dregs of the barrel, if you like. And it's said that Avalokiteshvara, or sometimes Vajrapani, come and drink that poison. And it turns their throat blue, so they become the Nilakanta, the blue-throated one, because they've had to swallow that poison. So yes, so there is a poison that comes up in relation to our friends that is the essence of all poisons. That poison is me. 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 That's the kind of mantra of that poison. Me. Me. It all comes back to me. And what do I get out of it? What's in it for me? This is the poison of self-clinging, clinging to a fixed and separate sense of self, fixing the world in terms of grasper and grasped. And this is what has to be destroyed. This is the real thing that has to be destroyed in the rite of destruction. It's delusion itself. And it's difficult because everything that we perceive is interpreted through the lens of self-clinging, of me. Me and you, you know, self and other, me and mine. And self-clinging takes over everything we experience. So I wanted to look at this process in a little bit more depth. So it is a little bit technical. If that puts you off, don't worry. Just you'll get a flavour of something. But if you enjoy that kind of analysis of mind, then you might enjoy this. Well, you won't enjoy it. You'll get something from it. Anyway, so there's three forms of ego clinging, of ego consciousness, self-clinging. The first is this is mine, which is based on thirst or craving. This is mine. So we've separated out the world in the sense of me and mine. And we say of ourselves, this is mine. And then we judge everything outside of ourselves into whether we can have it or not, how we can appropriate it or not. So this is the kind of thing where the sense of ego consciousness, where we're using... and I'll talk about it in terms of friendship. We're using our friend to fill a sense of ourselves from a sense of lack. There's this appropriative, there's appropriative consciousness at the heart of this self-other duality. You want to have, to make that sense of self feel complete and whole. We want to confirm where we are in the world. And this makes us, there are three forms of tanha or craving. One is this desire to grasp onto pleasure to make us feel real. Or grasp onto being, a sort of eternal existence to make ourselves feel real. Or even grasping onto oblivion, wanting to deny the self. Wanting to not be, wanting to just stop the whole thing because it's painful. So all of this is a kind of grasping in order to feel this fill this sense of inner lack and poverty. It's much deeper. This is mine is much deeper than just owning things. Owning things is the superficial level of it, really. What it really means is that it's even beyond language. It's that tendency to grab. To see the world in terms of what can be grasped, in terms of filling this sense of me. This is mine. This is myself. It's an existential situation. And we can use our friends in that way. You know, on a basic level, I don't know if you have this sense, but sometimes I get it sometimes at the end of a retreat, because of a retreat at Tirat Loka and... form very strong connections with people and quite a busy schedule, and particularly for the team. So then everyone leaves, and I don't quite know what to do with myself. And I sort of, I'm grasping after something, but I don't really know what it is I really want. And so we use friends in that space to sort of, we don't really know what we want, but we want them to do it for us. So yes, so the first sense of ego clinging is this is mine, trying to feel a sense of lack, make ourselves feel whole. Sometimes feeling a sense of sort of inner longing. We don't really know what it's for. We know there's a longing there, and we don't know how to solve it, so we just grasp onto people and things. The second form of ego consciousness is this I am, mana, conceit. And what this really means is the tendency to compare ourselves also with what's going on outside of ourselves. So in terms of friendship, we have this comparison, this I am and this you are. And we are always putting ourselves in sort of categories in relation to each other. Apparently, according to the Pali Canon, this arises at a pre-reflective level. So it's not something that we're even also deciding to do. And that's what pre-reflective means. It's not you're consciously deciding to do it. It's just that because we've divided reality into self and other in this fixed way, we're measuring ourselves all the time. And we come into a relationship with other things as other, and me as my, this I am, this you are. So, we all know how we do this. It's a kind of competitiveness. Even if we put ourselves underneath someone else, you know, we're always looking at things in relative terms. I am good, I am bad, I am rich, I am poor, I am stupid, I'm clever, I'm like them, I'm not like them. You kind of work out your relation yourself in relationship to others in this competitive and comparative way. It's very painful, actually, because basically we can always make an excuse about why we're different. I remember, I sometimes tell the story, when I was Mitchell Convener in Sheffield, and for some reason I had this day of a lot of meetings with people, and everyone came and said why they didn't fit in. And it was all different. You know, so like some people, literally I had some person saying, I don't fit in here because I'm too working class. And then someone else came and said, I don't fit in here because I'm too middle class. And then someone came and said, I don't fit in here because I'm too old. And this centre's just focused on young women. And then I had someone else coming saying, I'm too young and no one understands me. I thought this is all just madness. It's just madness. Stop it. You know, and I've done it myself. You know, well, in Sheffield, I had the I'm a southerner. And then I did my DNA testing and I found out that I'm 80% Northern English by my DNA. So I went back and told them that. And no one was impressed because I still say path in a puja. Anyway, we all have our crosses to bear. But I'm in the south, hooray, yeah. Yeah, so then the third one is this is myself. So we've got a view of ourselves, and the primary view is that I can't change. You've got a certain sphere of experience, and that is it. There's no going beyond that. There's no possibility of higher states of consciousness. There's no possibility of enlightenment. And we define ourselves in the world. In an uncertain world, we fix ourselves into roles. You know, I am a daughter, I am a girlfriend, I'm a wife, I'm an order member, I'm a mitra, I'm a friend, you know, I'm a doctor, I'm a teacher, whatever it is. And these roles aren't bad in themselves, but they create a fixed identity. They're a way of placing ourselves in the world. And identifying ourselves with particular views about ourselves and particular roles and a particular sort of consciousness or level of consciousness that we just assume is real. You know, this is mine. This is myself. And this, they say, conceit in self, so this I am, ends at enlightenment. But this is myself, as in view about yourself, ends at stream entry. There's a very, very interesting discussion that Sangharakshita gives about stream entry in the first three fetters in the T. Ratnavandana seminar. He talks about all the three fetters in terms of change. And he says, well, really, they're all about knowing on a profound level, really knowing in your bones that you can change, that this isn't it. However you've placed yourself isn't it. So self-view is not identifying yourself in roles, not identifying yourself by your old habits, but realizing on that profound level that you can change. Yeah, that there's a possibility of growth. So in the Pali canon, we also have four relationships out of this is mine, this I am, this is myself, which I hope you're getting a flavour, is quite a fixed way of being. We come into relationship with the world in four relationships to the perceived. So I'm going to apply this to friendship. So this is my own understanding. So, you know, it's limited to my own mind. So if you think of a different way of how these are expressed, that's fine. This is based on a traditional teaching, but I'm taking it into friendship. So the four relationships to the perceived is being identical with the perceived, contained within the perceived, it's all written up there, by the way, separated from the perceived or owning the perceived. So in friendship, if we're identical with the perceived, if we're identical with our friend, we want to like the same things and do the same things and think the same things and have the same sort of position in the world. And there's certain rules that we make that make our friendship real. So we've got a certain standard and way of being and behaving and thinking and doing that we think our friend should follow. So we kind of become one person in a way. We identify with each other as one person. There's two problems with this. One of them is that, of course, you're not going to get a doppelganger of you from your friend. We can't do that. And it can be very painful in friendship if one person starts to change, you know, and they start not to like the things you do or did, you know, and they don't think the same, have the same views, and they don't like the same things or do the same things. And what can happen is that when that person changes, we can feel betrayed. When actually, if we feel betrayed, it's often because we've identified with someone. We think that they should think the way we do and do what we do and like what we like. We can also find ourselves, if we're really identifying with our friend over in quite an extreme way, and I have had this with a friend before, because we're very close friends with them, we feel remorse for their actions because we've identified with them their self. So if they're the same as you and they do something unskillful, then you start to feel like you've done something wrong when actually you haven't, it was them. So, but that might be a bit down the line. I think the main thing is that, you know, we can feel quite angry and betrayed if someone changes because we've identified with them. The second one is being contained within someone, within our friend. So I was looking at this because on the setup we had two babies, and I was just looking at the, delighting really in the relationship with the mother and child, my friend and their child. And I noticed there's that beginning stage of childhood where you have to pay 100% attention to this little being when you're with them. And especially on this site, because they could just do anything, really, wander off into a ditch. And I noticed that Ruth's child particularly was walking along. She was really getting into walking down the path. And Ruth's a very, very good natural mother. And she just let the child walk down the path. But every so often, the child would turn around and just check that mum was there. And it's lovely. It's a very safe way of being. And I thought, oh, well, we must have, to a greater or lesser extent, we must have all been like that. We're waiting for reassurance and from our mothers. And I definitely have it with my father as well, actually, that, you know, we sort of search for them, and our lives are contained within their life, in a sense. And I suspect that sometimes that comes up in friendship where we want the same thing. You know, it's a bit embarrassing to admit, but there's some part of me that wants to be contained within my friend, to have that special intimacy with someone, that they'll always know where I am, and that they'll always look after me in a kind of special way, and that I don't have to really take full responsibility for myself, because they'll sort it out, you know, they'll be looking out for me. I wonder, and this is just a speculation, has anyone seen Fleabag?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, there's this... I was a bit resistant to Fleabag because I felt so upset for her in the first series. But anyway, in the second series, there's that bit in the confessional. You have to watch it to understand. But there's a bit in the confessional where she just says, I want someone to tell me what to wear in the morning. And then she goes on and starts saying that she basically just wants someone to tell her what to do and what choices to make. And to give up this terrible burden of responsibility that we all feel for our lives. You know, because it can be, Bhante talks about this, the burden of responsibility. We know we're responsible for this thing called life that we've been given. And we don't know how long it's going to last. And we know we've got to make something of it. And sometimes it can just be a burden. And we want someone to take that burden from us, to tell us what to do, when to eat, what to wear, what job to get, where to go on holiday. And just take that burden of responsibility from us. I won't say what happens next. Because I was brought up a Catholic. And I watched it with my mother, who's also a Catholic. Anyway, so you'll have to see. I can't tell you. So the third relationship with the perceived is to be separate from our friends. And then we get into this dynamic of sometimes competitiveness, a feeling of aloneness, and then this anxious, I think Karen Adee touched on this wanting and not wanting, you know, this sort of wanting friendship, but then doubt as to friendship being possible. And doubt that we really make a difference to our friends, and that that our friends really care about us, or that we mean anything to our friends. So we separate ourselves off. It can be quite confusing to be on the end of it, because you're having a lovely time, and then suddenly your friend goes whoop, or suddenly that's, you know, ourselves. We suddenly withdraw from the friendship. We separate ourselves off. We get into doubt around friendship. And the fourth relationship to the perceived is owning. So you want to control your friend. It's another extension of selfhood. In ancient India, the concept of selfhood was very much bound up with control. If you control it, it's yours. So if your friend, if you can control your friend, they're yours. And they'll be yours forever. They're my friend forever. So these are the kind of deeper existential pulls that happen right at the basis of friendship. And they're all really about appropriating our friends as an object. And we have to confront these pushes and pulls. And it is uncomfortable. You know, it's a tender, uncomfortable thing. They're deep psychological, and, well, even deeper than this. Even deeper than psychological, they're sort of the root of existence itself. You know, some of these pulls don't get, you don't release until enlightenment. So we're working with some very, very deep pulls of samsara. And in a way, sometimes we can sort of see it at its root within friendship and also outside of friendship. But how it comes to me is the great fruit of my solitary retreats for over 20 years was when I got to a point when I sat down and I suddenly saw how utterly selfish I am. You know, when it comes down to it, it's me, you know. And actually, the strange thing is when I really realised this, the kind of like slimy dregs underneath it all, the stuff that's not really going to shift by niceness, I just felt this total relief. I've seen you. I know you. So, yeah, so we have to face these deeper pools, and we also have to face the reality of death, you know, that that we might die and our friends might die. Sometimes I find this as well in friendship. I think there's a moment when I'm getting really close to someone and I think, I can't have them, I can't own them, and they might die. I was very pleased that Akasa Jyoti brought Bhante's friend Terry into the puja last night, because Terry, who was a great friend of Bhante, unfortunately he took his own life. And if you read Moving Against the Stream, Bhante talks about it. And he says he wept every single day for 6 months. And he wrote this poem that you might be familiar with. Hour after hour, day after day, we try to grasp the ungraspable, pinpoint the unpredictable. Flowers wither when touched. Ice suddenly cracks beneath our feet. Vainly we try to track bird flight through the sky, trace dumb fish through deep water, try to anticipate the earned smile, the soft reward. Even try to grasp our own lives. But life slips through our fingers like snow. Life cannot belong to us. We belong to life. Life is king. So when you know the background of that poem, it takes on a special importance, because this was Bhante's friend, and Bhante talked to him through the night, trying to help him to see a different perspective. And in the end, he couldn't control what Terry was going to do. He couldn't prevent that. And Terry died. So what do we do in the face of these deeper existential pulls and in the face of death? Well, Bhante says that friendship is the emotional counterpart to the fixed self, no fixed self doctrine. Because ego clinging is not a thing. It's not a thing that we destroy. We don't destroy ourselves. We don't destroy other people. We don't destroy our ego. What we do is we keep expanding beyond the ego. So he says, actually, the ego clinging is a way of being, not a thing. And what we're releasing is that way of being. Ego clinging is a way of being which is cut off from the world in a tight, enclosed ball. But release of ego clinging is when we reach out beyond ourselves, when we expand, when we take others in. So from appropriating our friend, we delight in our friend and we give. So, yeah, I was thinking about this in some ways is, yes, so Bhante talks about releasing ego clinging is about expanding beyond this tight self-concern. I was thinking about it also as surrendering. We just have to surrender to the process of friendship and to all the pushes and pulls that it gives rise to, and to all the ebb and flow of life and death. We just have to surrender to that, to surrender to the process of friendship itself. And let friendship itself take us beyond ourselves. Because what happens in self-clinging is that we're always coming back to the gravitational pull of the self. That's how Sangharakshita talks about it. There's a gravitational pull of the self and we're always coming back to it. And this gravitational pull is fear. There's the gravitational pull of fear of intimacy, fear of this edge that we reach between self and other, fear that we might dissolve into our friend. I think that's sometimes that we'll lose our sense of self, or fear that we might create something real and important that has real and lasting consequences, and you suddenly realise that actually, yes, you do have an effect on your friend, you know. You are creating each other in a particular way all the time. And where am I in this? And where are you? And where's the edge between me and you? And what do I do now in this? And there's a fear of what will happen if I open up, a fear of being seen, a fear of telling all those petty things, of a fear of saying things to your friend like, actually, I kind of want you to be my mother, you know. You know, I even have a fear of sort of giving my friends a hug. I was feeling a lot of affection for Karen Adee this morning. And I just did the typical thing that I always do when I'm feeling affection. Just squeeze her shoulder. She went, "What's going on, sweetie? I'm just feeling affection for you." I'm English and I'm Southern. It's a burden. It's a burden. So, yeah, so we have to face our own separation and aloneness. I think this is what happens in friendship. We have to face our own aloneness and our interrelationship, and our connectedness to others. So in some ways, yes, we are alone. We have to face this burden of existence ourselves, and no one can heal our wounds or complete us. You know, no one can heal your wounds. No one can complete you. Gosh. You've got to face that loneliness, the stark truth of aloneness and sometimes loneliness. And facing this is an indispensable basis of friendship, because otherwise we're always looking to our friends to solve something for us. But actually, if we face our own aloneness and we learn to take responsibility for our own wounds and our own sense of completeness or lack of completeness, and we take that up as an adult kind of project, other people will joyfully join in. When you see someone taking responsibility for themselves and entering into a creative relationship with themselves, one feels a kind of delight and wants to help. But no one can do it for you. No one can do it for you. In a sense, we do carry this burden of aloneness ourselves. And sometimes it's a burden. Sometimes we can put that burden down. Yes, our existence is ours to shape and no one else's. There's a wonderful bit in the Sutta Nipata from the oldest part of the Pali Canon where the Buddha turns to his disciples and he said, "The monk must look for peace within himself and not in any other place. For when a person is inwardly quiet, there is nowhere a self can be found. Where then could a non-self be found? There are no waves in the depths of the sea. It is still, unbroken. It is the same with a monk. He is still, without a quiver of desire, without a remnant on which to build pride or desire. The Dharmacharini must look for peace within herself and not in any other place. For when a person is inwardly quiet, there is nowhere a self can be found. Where then could a non-self be found? There are no waves in the depths of the sea. It is still, unbroken. It is the same with the Dharmacharini." I've forgotten the last bit. "She is still, without a quiver of desire, without a remnant on which to build pride or desire." So yes, we've got to look for peace within ourselves. And yet, at the same time, we're not alone. We belong to life. Yes, life does not belong to us, but we do belong to life. And sometimes we can step sort of out of our aloneness into the sacredness of life. So that's another part of solitary retreats for me, is realizing the absolute sacredness of life. I can't describe it in any other sense. This kind of incredible movement of life and the sacredness of life and all the beings in it. We have to step into our relationship with trees and flowers and friendship and all the things of life. Satchamuni was saying this morning, we have to step into our inheritance from the Buddha. He said, "You are born of my mouth, born of my breast, heir to the Dharma, followers of the Dharma, not heirs to material things." And when Tsongkhapa gained enlightenment, it said that what he really realized, his content of his enlightenment experience, was realizing the profound interconnectedness and interdependence of everything, and realize what a wonderful difference he could make in the world. So yes, we face these forces, we face our aloneness, we face that incredible interrelationship within friendship. And we destroy conceit and craving and views that get in the way of that relationship to the world, that creative relationship to the world. I got a text from Padmavajra about this talk, and he said, what did he say? Something like, he said, "All that status and everything, it just gets in the way of friendship, and we've just got to drop it. It's transcendental." There you go. So yes, so destruction is destroying everything that gets in the way of friendship, and really undermining this self-clinging at its roots. And it also means we have to come into relationship with our own power and potency. We will have to deeply change within this. There's no going back. And we have to realize that actually we do have an effect on others, and we have an effect on ourselves, and we have that power within ourselves. Sometimes the rite of destruction can be, you know, we're pretty nervous of that kind of thing, because it sounds, well, it had its origins in violence, in killing people. So, you know, maybe it's justified we have resistance to that. But it's the kind of force of destruction that the Buddha had when he says on his enlightenment, "O house builder, now you are seen. You will not build this house again. Your rafters are all broken and your ridge poles shattered. The conditioned mind too has gone to destruction. I have attained the cessation of craving." So how do we do this within friendship? We're on to the Sangrahavastu of Samanartata today. So in the Buddha's advice to in the Sigalaka Sutta, he says, the friend is the same in happy and unhappy times. They tell you their secrets, they guard your secrets, they do not let you down in misfortune. They will even sacrifice their life for your good. And I think what this means is really creating an atmosphere where people can explore those deeper forces and the deeper tensions within life. Their secrets, real secrets, not just like what you did one day when you were drunk, but real, I mean that too, but the depths of what really goes on. The secrets of our inner world, that citadel of our heart. Do we have to let the drawbridge down at some point and let someone in? And, you know, there's a lot we'll find in there. We'll find good things and we'll find bad things. We'll find murky depths, existential angst. We'll go through light and dark together. And how do we create this atmosphere? Well, one meaning of the word samanartata is exemplification. Not holding back on communication, not allowing one person to do the depths and not you, but sharing mutually our deeper exploration. becoming spiritually naked together. Which is, you know, quite apt for this retreat. Yes. You've got to share the hot tub of the spiritual life together. Studying together, confession practice, talking about meditation. I know that sometimes when I'm met with friends, I like to study together. Jyoti and I have done a really good study together, actually, because I think through that study, something deeper comes out. So often I study with my friends, just one-to-one. It doesn't really matter what you study. It's just allowing that, it just takes communication a bit more pointed, a bit deeper. And yes, allowing yourself to be revealed. I remember there was a time in the community in Dharma Dinner, used to be our president, she came and did some study with us, and she said to us at one point, "Do you experience competitiveness towards each other?" And we went, no. No, we're friends. And then I think it was me, it might have been Kelly Chitta, but one of us, it's usually one of us, went, "Actually, yeah, I do." And it all came out. You know, these precious things like people's ordination processes and precepting and being a Kalyana Mitra, all these wonderful things that we have, and we were experiencing competitiveness about it. It was, oh. But, you know, that really helped. That conversation helped us take us deeper. Money, that was the other conversation like that. How much money do you have? And what are your attitudes to it? Gosh. So yeah, so that's one way, it's just taking communication deeper. And also feedback. So sometimes we have to say uncomfortable things. There's an aphorism of Bhante's where he says, "One either communicates or is blocked. There is no middle way." So yes, we have to say those uncomfortable things, and we have to learn to receive those uncomfortable things. If you think the ordination process is bad, You haven't gone the consultation process, let me tell you, to become a private preceptor. My goodness. It's not even that kind of nice sandwich. You know, the nice bit of the beginning and the nice bit of the end and the horrible bit. No. It's right in there. You know, and if you're on the ordination team, you get it like 1,000 times worse. You have, well, how was it? My discussion, there was 4 hours or something with the community talking about me. And I remember my tray saying to me, "Just open up, just open up, just take it." Oh, things that I'd come up in my ordination process, it was awful.
You're not selling it.
No. And yet, what an opportunity.
Now we have this beautiful
being. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yes. In a way, it was really, really helpful. And there's this really sort of weird udana in the Pali Canon where the Buddha says, "Rain soddens what is covered up. It does not sodden what is open. Therefore, uncover what is covered, and the rain will not sodden it."
So I'm talking about this country.
Yeah. Talking about India in the rainy season, which is worse. And he's doing this kind of paradox where basically if you open up, you're not going to be destroyed by it. Mm. It doesn't mean you have to agree with everything, but usually there's something in it. Sometimes it's not quite what someone makes a conclusion that you don't quite think follows, but there is something. There's always a jewel in that feedback, in my experience. So, yes, so we have to give feedback. But I have noticed that sometimes in the movement, particularly actually in the young people's movement recently, I've noticed there's a tendency to, or drive to give feedback in quite a harsh way that excludes dialogue and excludes compassion. Bhante talked about this as paying homage to the ideal without actually practicing it. You do a lot of... Good one, isn't it? Yeah.
If
you're paying homage to the ideal without actually practicing it. So basically, it's very easy to criticise from the sidelines, you know. I think about this with the poor public preceptors. You know, they don't get a pay rise for being a public preceptor. And yet, you know, there's a lot of criticism. Some of it might be justified, but to be on the end of that is really hard work, actually. So, yes, so it's easy to criticise from the sidelines. And we have to face the fact that just because we think someone's done something wrong, we might be wrong ourselves. So if we give feedback, we need to be open to discussion about it. And perhaps think more in terms of setting up conditions for feedback, setting up the conditions by which you're going to have that open communication, rather than just, you know, like I did, I've really had to work on this myself, sort of jumping in with the machine gun, actually setting up the conditions for a fruitful communication. And then when you give the feedback, something really wonderful can occur and you can become much deeper friends. So there's five conditions for feedback in the giving feedback in the Pali Canon. I won't go into them because I'm running out of time, but it's the first and most important thing is to cultivate a mind of metta. So you're not in a state of hatred when you're actually speaking to someone. Choose the right time. You know, choose the right time when they're not busy or overwhelmed in any way, where you've got time to discuss it. Using speech that is kind, you know, not harsh speech. Using speech that is true, so not making massive generalizations, checking out your facts first. And doing it for the long-term benefit of the friendship, so not just doing it because you want to get one over there on them, basically. So, yes, yeah, setting up conditions for saying difficult things. And in the Sigalaka Sutta, he talks about sacrificing your life for your friend's good. It doesn't necessarily mean literally, could mean. But I think it's just trying to enter into the other aspect of Samanartata, which means treating others as yourself. So treating their life is as important as your life. So there's that lovely bit in the Anuruddhas where they say, why should I not set aside what I want to do and do what they want to do? And in that, why don't I set aside what I want to do and do what they want to do? Is just seeing yourself as part of a harmonious whole, not prioritizing the self over your friend. Just experimenting with that. In a way, what we're trying to do is you're trying to blow that structure of friendship apart, that structure that says, I'm here and you're there, and I want or I don't want you, you know. Seeing each other as the great mystery, imbuing ourselves with the mystery of other. That's one the way Denise Levertov talks about it. Imbuing ourselves with the mystery of the other and the mystery of ourselves. So, of course, the near enemy to this is a kind of martyrdom where we put ourselves down and we see ourselves less important than our friends. You're not less and you're not more important than your friends. You're part of the same whole. In fact, that whole way of looking at your friends as less important and more important is an illusion itself. So it's not always putting yourself underneath someone. There's a wonderful story of Bhante's guru. Apparently had one eye and was 600 years old. He's a great character. And he said, as low as you go, I can always go lower. And as high as you go, I can always go higher. He said, the great problem in the spiritual life is pride. Anyway, that's a story. It's a great story.
Who was that?
I can't remember his name. He's in the Thousand Petalos, which is Rainbow Road now. Yeah. Rainbow Road. It's hilarious, absolutely hilarious. Anyway, really want to tell it to you, but I can't. So yes, and the other near enemy of this rite, the rite of destruction, is bypassing. So having an intellectual understanding of no self, and thinking it's the whole thing, thinking we've gone beyond our self clinging, when actually we've gone beyond an idea of our self clinging. It's interesting that Bhante talks as a old interview, and someone says, well, you know, you can go on an enlightenment in a weekend course, And he looks with absolute horror and says, but how do you think you could gain enlightenment in one weekend? He said, enlightenment is a whole transformation of being from the depth to the heights. And that kind of whole transformation of being takes lifetimes, you know. You're not going to do it in a weekend unless you've done some serious practice in your previous life. I think what can happen to us, in a way for me, what's more interesting is that why would someone want to go on an enlightenment in a weekend course?
Saves time.
Yeah, saves time. It saves time. And in a way, you've got to respect that. People really want the intensity. They really want to gain enlightenment, which is a good thing. But I think what we can do is we can get a bit intoxicated and addicted even to having the big experience and to that kind of intensity. We can get addicted to intensity. And we can dismiss the ordinary magic of friendship to get to the real deal. But the real deal is to be found within the ordinary friendship. Anatta, releasing this fixed self view, is found within ordinary friendship. And in a way, it's much more challenging to give and receive ordinary love between friends than it is to reflect on the non-self doctrine. You know, I can reflect on the non-self doctrine in my bedroom, but, you know, when it really comes to sharing my life with others, that's much more challenging, which is why Bhante says, you know, you need the emotional counterpart and as well as the intellectual counterpart of the non-fixed self doctrine. And he says that within our love, the love and communication between our friends, he says the self and other distinction can fall apart. Where he says we can get into an element of communication where distinctions have no meaning. And at that point, we enter into the deep silence of friendship. Another near enemy of the right of destruction is harsh speech. Yes, this kind of very critical feedback. And there was a time in the movement where there was this idea of fierce friendship. We all had to have fierce friendship with each other. And I remember Tarika talking about it because her and her friend were living together and they got on really well. And they thought maybe we're getting on too well and we should have more fierce friendship. And so they started picking fights with each other. And then it came out of the porridge. And then they just both started laughing and saying, actually, we just get on quite well and there isn't really a problem about the porridge. So anyway. Yeah. There's a very few times where I've really had to exercise my power over someone in the name of friendship, and that is always in subordination to the love mode, and that's always, I can only think of two times I've really done it, and that was because I thought if I didn't do it, they would harm themselves. And I was sure about that. I was sure it wasn't any negativity on my part. And I've had to apply it to myself as well when I was in a state of I was in a state of real hatred, and I was worried that actually my hatred would actually have a physical effect on that person. And I really took myself in hand and took myself to my preceptor and confessed in front of her. So yes, it's only a very few times where I've really thought anger, or not anger, but that kind of real power is necessary, and that's only in the face of great unskillfulness. And it's always in subordination to the love mode. But the far enemy of the right of destruction is to shy away from real exploration, to keep it light. And I know that in study groups at Tiratnaloka, you can find them, you know, you have one study group and something starts to happen and people start to really go into their depths. Real exploration of very important pools of their sort of psyche and practice. And suddenly someone will say something really superficial and light, and the whole study group will just go boing. And I think it's just because we're frightened of going deeper. So then suddenly you give a funny story. And I know I do this as well. So yes, so when fear arises, the Buddha's advice is to stay with it. To recognize the demon, this I am. And to bring to mind metta, to bring in the force of metta. He said, metta fortifies the mind. Metta is a force. He said, love is no mere flabby sentiment. It's the vigorous identification of one human being with another. Buddhism will change us, and friendship will change us, and we are vulnerable to each other, even on the ordination team. You know, it's not like the ordination team can put their life on hold and then have communication and go on retreat. You know, going on retreats is our life. We spend most of our time on retreats with people. So we're vulnerable. We're vulnerable to projections with each other, scared of rejection, scared of engulfment, scared of not being liked, scared of being liked too much, scared of falling off our projections. All these things arise. And it takes a great heart of metta to keep going with them. And when I was thinking about the rite of destruction, I was remembering that picture that's in Tibet, in one of the Dalai Lama's palaces. There's a picture of Padmasambhava with a demon at his feet that Aloka copied for his picture of Padmasambhava at Padmaloka. And there's this little demon at his feet. It's the demon of ego clinging, I reckon. And the demon's looking up, and he's a bit sly and a bit naughty. And the Buddha, and Padmasambhava is just doing the demon subduing gesture, but he's got this look on his face of such kindness and warmth. And then I thought, well, that's the rite of the destruction. It's like you're just being a bit naughty, aren't you? You know, it's not death. We don't want to be Milarepa, you know, having given way to that kind of black rite of destruction in that negative sense. Really, it's about subduing the demons by learning their true name and by just completely suffusing them with love. So I'll end there. Mm-hmm.